It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Back in the late 1960s, when Brian Goldman went to medical school,
yeah,
he was a perfect student. Perfect.
The slang term they used back then was a browner.
That's Brian.
I'm a staff emergency physician at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto, Canada.
That's Toronto.
You know, but 30 years ago, it was Toronto.
Because I used to say Toronto, and Canadians would correct me.
And say Toronto, yeah.
Toronto. There's no T in it. Anyway, Brian went to medical school in that city, and he described it in his TED Talk.
I was an obsessive compulsive student. In high school, a classmate once said that Brian Goldman would study for a blood test. And so I did. And I memorized everything. I memorized in my anatomy class the origins and insertions of every muscle, every branch of every artery that came off the aorta. And all the while, I was amassing more and more knowledge, and I did well. I graduated with honors, cum laude.
I wanted to be the smartest physician I could be so that I wouldn't be like those other physicians who were less competent, who didn't learn as much as I did. And it's interesting, when I talk to medical students today, many of them, have that look in their eyes that they're pristine. They've never made a mistake and they never will. And, of course, until it happens.
Today on the program, mistakes. They happen. We're going to talk with TED speakers about why they have to happen and when they do happen, how we deal with being wrong. The way doctors deal with mistakes, well, that's what Brian Goldman is really interested in. Because doctors don't just hate making mistakes, they also hate talking about them. So, aside from his day job as an ER doc...
This week on White Coat Black Art...
I'm the host of White Coat Black Art, a show about the culture of modern medicine on CBC Radio 1.
As he described in his TED Talk, over the past few years, Brian Goldman's used his radio show to focus on mistakes. And he'd bring doctors onto the show, and he'd ask them one question. He'd ask, what's the worst mistake they ever made?
And I would point the microphone towards them, and their pupils would dilate, and they would... recoil. Then they would look down and swallow hard and start to tell me their stories.
Well, unfortunately, I was involved in a medication error in which a resident I was supervising, and hence I was responsible, administered a drug which caused a very serious side effect.
I missed a subarachnoid, a brain bleed, and I was really devastated. I actually went home and dissolved into a puddle of tears. I was really, really upset. Now, thank God the outcome was fine.
There was another story that somebody told you at a town hall.
Yeah, that was the CEO of a hospital.
Do you have a personal story?
I do.
Very respected guy who told the story of the time that he missed a fracture.
Missed fracture in a child. And it was a circumstance.
And oh, how terrible it was that child had to
suffer, regrettably, unnecessary pain for an extra day.
Until the fracture was discovered and could be properly treated, presumably with a cast. And I thought to myself, if that's the worst mistake you've ever made, boy, you've had a really soft career.
So, yeah, doctors don't really want to talk about this sort of thing, but... In his TED Talk, Brian Goldman did, and here's where the story really starts. He was a few years at a medical school where, remember, he was an A student. No slip-ups, no shortcomings, no mistakes.
Until I met Mrs. Drucker. I was a resident at a teaching hospital here in Toronto when Mrs. Drucker was brought to the emergency department at the hospital where I was working. At the time, I was assigned to the cardiology service on a cardiology rotation. And it was my job when the emergency staff called for a cardiology consult to see that patient in emerge and to report back to my attending. And I saw Mrs. Drucker and she was breathless, and when I listened to her, she was making a wheezy sound, and when I listened to her chest with a stethoscope, I could hear crackly sounds on both sides that told me that she was in congestive heart failure. And I set to work treating her. I gave her aspirin. I gave her medications to relieve the strain on her heart. I gave her medications that we call diuretics, water pills, to get her to pee out the excess fluid. And over the course of the next hour and a half or two, she started to feel better. And I felt really good. And that's when I made my first mistake. I sent her home. Maybe I didn't want to be a high-maintenance resident. Maybe I wanted to be so successful and so able to take responsibility that I would do so and I would be able to take care of my attending's patients without even having to contact him. In sending her home, I disregarded a little voice deep down inside that was trying to tell me, Goldman, not a good idea. Don't do this. In fact, so lacking in confidence was I that I actually asked the nurse who was looking after Mrs. Drucker, do you think it's okay if she goes home? And the nurse thought about it and said very matter-of-factly, yeah, I think she'll do okay. I can remember that like it was yesterday. And so I signed the discharge papers and an ambulance came, paramedics came to take her home. And I went back to my work on the wards. All the rest of that day, that afternoon, I had this kind of gnawing feeling inside my stomach. But I carried on with my work, and at the end of the day, I packed up to leave the hospital and walked to the parking lot to take my car and drive home, when I did something that I don't usually do. I walked through the emergency department on my way home. And it was there that another nurse, not the nurse who was looking after Mrs. Drucker before, but another nurse said three words to me that are the three words that most emergency physicians I know dread. Others in medicine dread them as well, but there's something particular about emergency medicine because we see patients so fleetingly. The three words are, do you remember? Do you remember that patient you sent home? The other nurse asked matter-of-factly. Well, she's back, in just that tone of voice. Well, she was back all right. She was back and near death. About an hour after she had arrived home, after I'd sent her home, she collapsed. And her family called 911, and the paramedics brought her back to the emergency department, where she had a blood pressure of 50, which is in severe shock. And she was barely breathing, and she was blue. And they gave her medications to raise her blood pressure. They put her on a ventilator. And, you know, I was shocked and shaken to the core. And I went through this roller coaster because after they stabilized her, she went to the intensive care unit, and I hoped against hope that she would recover. And over the next two or three days, it was clear that she was never going to wake up. She had irreversible brain damage. And the family gathered, and over the course of the next 8 or 9 days, they resigned themselves to what was happening. At about the 9-day mark, they let her go. Mrs. Drucker, a wife, a mother, and a grandmother. They say you never forget the names of those who die, and that was my first time to be acquainted with that.
What did you tell her family? I mean, did you speak with him?
No, I didn't. And I'm sorry about that. It was a different time, and the cardiologist was incredibly supportive.
This was the attending physician who knew the family.
Yeah. His first reaction was to have a pained look on his face, but he spoke to the family, and I gather they were very understanding.
You say you'll never forget her name.
Yes.
Mrs. Drucker.
No, that's not her name, of course, but no. I could give you her name offline, but that would be violating confidentiality, and yes, no, I do remember her name.
How long did it take you before you were prepared to talk about that mistake publicly?
Decades. It took me decades.
And I'd like to be able to say to you that my worst mistakes only happened in the first 5 years of practice, as many of my colleagues say, which is total BS. Some of my doozies have been in the last 5 years. If I can't come clean and talk about my mistakes, if I can't find the still small voice that tells me what really happened, how can I share it with my colleagues? How can I teach them about what I did so that they don't do the same thing? We work in a system where errors happen every day, where 1 in 10 medications are either the wrong medication given in hospital or at the wrong dosage, where hospital-acquired infections are getting more and more numerous, causing havoc and death. In this country, as many as 24,000 Canadians die of preventable medical errors. In the United States, the Institute of Medicine pegged it at 100,000. In both cases, these are gross underestimates because we really aren't ferreting out the problem as we should. You know that business about people not wanting to talk about their worst cases? What they need is an environment to be able to do that. What they need is a redefined medical culture. And it starts with one physician at a time. The redefined physician is human, knows she's human, accepts it, isn't proud of making mistakes, but strives to learn one thing from what happened that she can teach to somebody else. And she works in a culture of medicine that acknowledges that human beings run the system, and when human beings run the system, they will make mistakes from time to time, and also fosters in a loving, supportive way places where everybody who is observing in the healthcare system can actually point out things that could be potential mistakes and is rewarded for doing so. And especially people like me, when we do make mistakes, we're rewarded for coming clean.
You said in your talk, we have this idea that if we drive the people who make mistakes out of medicine, what will we be left with but a safe system and a bad system?
We would be left with a system that has all the flaws that it has today. And it would be a very lonely system because there would be very few people in it.
And few people taking risks? I mean, risks that might save a life?
Now, that's an interesting question. Most of the greatest successes in medicine come from failure. They don't get planned out and executed perfectly the first time. You know, there are wondrous treatments that exist today on the backs of people who died. And I can tell you, I've saved a lot of people off the backs of the people who paid for my mistakes.
Brian Goldman. I'm Guy Raz. On the show today, making mistakes. Why we have to. Stay with us. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and we're talking about mistakes, making them, admitting them, making ourselves vulnerable, and what happens when you do. Just a moment ago, we heard from Brian Goldman, who gets doctors to talk about their biggest errors, and sometimes he has a hard time getting them to open up. But Brené Brown, she has the opposite problem. Do people come up to you pretty often?
Yeah, probably at least once a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's Brené.
And I'm a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work.
Now, research professors don't normally get recognized by strangers in the supermarket on a regular basis, but Brené, she's different. Do people, like, bare their souls to you?
Yeah, sometimes.
They just come up to you and say, I need to tell you something.
I don't think they really share inappropriately or anything, but they'll come up and say, oh my God, I was going through a divorce and I saw your talk and I was like, that's it, screw it, I'm going to be wholehearted, I'm going to live in love with my whole heart. And I'm always thinking, you know, right on.
Brené studies vulnerability and how it affects almost all of our thoughts and decisions and really our lives. And she gave a TEDx talk in Houston all about it. And what happened?
No, what happened?
What happened was that even by TED standards, this thing was huge, more than 8 million views. That's why people come up to her in the street. And what made Brené's talk different? Well, Brené's a numbers person, but wrapped up in that data is a very personal story, a story about how she learned to embrace vulnerability.
I felt like for the first time really in my career, this total freedom to try something new. And I thought about it, and I thought about, well, why don't I just try something really scary, and I'll be vulnerable while I'm talking about vulnerability.
And so I want to talk to you and tell some stories about a piece of my research that fundamentally expanded my perception and really actually changed the way that I live and love and work and parent. So very quickly, really about 6 weeks into this research, I ran into this unnamed thing that absolutely unraveled connection in a way that I didn't understand or had never seen. And so I pulled back out of the research and thought, I need to figure out what this is. And it turned out to be shame. And shame is really easily understood as the fear of disconnection. Is there something about me that if other people know it or see it, that I won't be worthy of connection? The things I can tell you about it, it's universal. We all have it. The only people who don't experience shame have no capacity for human empathy or connection. No one wants to talk about it, and the less you talk about it, the more you have it. What underpinned this shame, this I'm not good enough, which we all know that feeling, I'm not blank enough, I'm not thin enough, rich enough, beautiful enough, smart enough, promoted enough. The thing that underpinned this was excruciating vulnerability. This idea of, in order for connection to happen, we have to allow ourselves to be seen, really seen. And you know how there are people that, like, when they realize that vulnerability and tenderness are important, that they kind of surrender and walk into it? A, that's not me. And B, I don't even hang out with people like that. For me, it was a year-long street fight. It was a slugfest. Vulnerability pushed, I pushed back. I lost the fight, but probably won my life back. And so then I went back into the research and spent the next couple of years really trying to understand what they, the wholehearted, what the choices they were making, and what are we doing with vulnerability? Why do we struggle with it so much? Am I alone in struggling with vulnerability? No. So this is what I learned. We numb vulnerability. Having to ask my husband for help because I'm sick and we're newly married. Being turned down, asking someone out, waiting for the doctor to call back, getting laid off, laying off people. This is the world we live in. And one of the ways we deal with it is we numb vulnerability. You cannot selectively numb. So when we numb those, we numb joy. We numb gratitude. We numb happiness.
So Brené kept researching vulnerability, and 2 years later, she was back on the TED stage.
There's two things that I've learned in the last year. The first is vulnerability is not weakness. And that myth is profoundly dangerous. And I've come to the belief, this is my 12th year doing this research, that vulnerability is our most accurate measurement of courage.
How?
This came up a lot when we asked people, what's something from an example from their lives that they would use to describe vulnerability? And a lot of people said vulnerability is picking up the phone and calling someone who's just been through something tragic or traumatic. And, you know, we all kind of do the same thing. We look at the phone and we think, oh my God, I've got to call her. I can't believe her husband had a heart attack and died. I've got to call. And we kind of circle the phone and we think, I don't know. Maybe I'll call later because, you know, what am I going to say? And so I think when we finally call, and the hard thing about that call is we know that there's nothing we can say to make things better. All we can do is say, I'm with you in this. I'm hurting for you. You're not alone. When we pick up the phone and make that call and we hang up and we walk away from the phone, we feel courageous. We feel like we've had the courage to live in integrity. We're aligned with our values. So let me ask you this question. Have you ever had, I'll put you on the spot.
Sure.
Have you ever had that situation where you really needed to make that call, but you didn't?
Yes. Yes.
Me too. Yeah. I have too. And then what is that feeling that you have when you run into that person at the grocery store a month later?
Shame.
Yeah.
I mean, total shame.
Yeah.
You want to avoid them. You can't look in their eyes.
You do. So then you've got a person who's in grief, probably feeling really alone and isolated, and you're hiding behind the potato chip aisle. I think vulnerability is courage. I think it's about coming through in times of deep uncertainty and of deep fear and emotional risk. I think that's brave. I think it's brave to show up.
Is it necessary? Do you have to
yes.
do it?
Yeah, because here's the thing. If vulnerability is indeed uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure, then to be human is to be vulnerable. To be in relationship is to be vulnerable. To be, you know, professionally engaged at work is to be vulnerable. We're up against uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure every day, all day. And so I think the myth, that the dangerous myth, is that we can say, oh, that's a neat topic that I heard them talking about on the radio, but, you know, I don't really do vulnerability. No, you do it. every single day. You know, one of the things I've said before is, you know, live tweeting your bikini wax is not vulnerability. You know, sharing the intimate details of your child's emotional response to your divorce on Facebook is not vulnerability.
That's too much information.
Definitely. It's one of the big four myths of vulnerability, that vulnerability is letting it all hang out.
Right.
Embedded in real vulnerability is an honest, raw bid for connection. And, you know, if I get really shamed by a colleague in front of clients at work or something, and I come home and I put on Facebook, man, got totally shamed at work by so-and-so and feel small and stupid, I might get 20 comments from other people that say, I hate when that happens. It's happened to me. You're not alone, brother. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's normalizing. But nowhere in that is there a raw bid for connection. If I called you after work and said, hey, guy, it's Brené, and do you have a minute? Because I just went into this total shame spiral at work, and I'm just feeling I'm devastated. That's a very vulnerable bid, because I'm saying, do you have time and do you care enough to spend a few minutes talking to me about something that's hard? And so, in my view, vulnerability is about intimacy, trust, and connection. We share our stories with people who've earned the right to hear them.
One of the weird things that's happened is after the TED explosion, I got a lot of offers to speak all over the country. Everyone from schools and parent meetings to Fortune 500 companies. And so many of the calls went like this. Hey, Dr. Brown, we loved your TED Talk. We'd like you to come in and speak. We'd appreciate it if you wouldn't mention vulnerability or shame. What would you like for me to talk about? There's three big answers. This is mostly, to be honest with you, from the business sector. Innovation, creativity, and change. So let me go on the record and say, vulnerability is the birthplace of innovation, creativity, and change. To create is to make something that has never existed before. There's nothing more vulnerable than that. Adaptability to change is all about vulnerability.
The truth is, when failure's not an option, we have a bunch of scared people hanging around, loitering on the outside of the arena. You know, the bottom line is, if you're going to go into the arena, you're going to get your butt kicked.
That's
scary. You're going to come up with an idea that just, you know, sucks. But, you know, as scary and dangerous as that sounds, I don't think it's as scary and dangerous as spending your entire life on the outside wondering, what if I would have shown up? What if I would have pitched that idea? What if I would have said yes? What if I would have taken that job? What if I would have turned down that job and spent the year doing this crazy project that I really believed in? To me, that's far more dangerous.
And so I'll leave you with this thought. If we're going to find our way back to each other, vulnerability is going to be that path. And I know it's seductive to stand outside the arena, because I think I did it my whole life, and think to myself, I'm going to go in there and kick some ass when I'm bulletproof and when I'm perfect. And that is seductive. But the truth is, that never happens. And even if you got as perfect as you could and as bulletproof as you could possibly muster, when you got in there, that's not what we want to see. We want you to go in. We want to be with you and across from you. And we just want, for ourselves and for the people we care about and the people we work with, to dare greatly. So thank y'all very much. I really appreciate it.
That's Brené Brown. You can watch both of her TED Talks at our website, ted.npr.org. This is music by Stefan Harris and his jazz quartet. And today on the show, we're talking about admitting mistakes, being vulnerable, being wrong, and, well, Stefan's TED Talk is about a place where mistakes don't really exist.
So the bandstand, as we call it, this is an incredible space. It is really a sacred space. And one of the things that is really sacred about it is that you have no opportunity to think about the future or the past. You really are alive right here in this moment. There are so many decisions being made when you walk on the bandstand. So the idea of a mistake, the way I perceive a mistake when I'm on the bandstand, first of all, we don't really see it as a mistake. The only mistake lies in that I'm not able to perceive what it is that someone else did. Every mistake is an opportunity in jazz. So if something, it's hard to even describe what a funny note would be. So for example, if I played a color like we were playing in a palette that sounded like this. So if Christian played a note like playing F, see these are all right inside of the color palette. If he played an E, see these all lie right inside of this general emotional palette that we were painting. If he played an F sharp though, to most people's ear, they would perceive that as a mistake. So I'm gonna show you, we're gonna play just for a second and we're gonna play on this palette, and at some point Christian will introduce this note and we won't react to it. He'll introduce it for a second and I'll stop. I'll talk for a second. Ready? Well, no. Well, let's see what happens. We play with this palette. So someone could conceptually perceive that as a mistake. And the only way that I would say it was a mistake is in that we didn't react to it. It was an opportunity that was missed. So it's unpredictable. We'll paint this palette again. He'll play it. I don't know how we'll react to it, but something will change. We'll all accept his ideas or not. You see, he played this note. I ended up creating a melody out of it. The texture changed in the drums this time. He got a little bit more rhythmic, a little bit more intense in response to the way that I responded to it. So there is no mistake. The only mistake is if I'm not aware, if each individual musician is not aware and accepting enough of his fellow band member to incorporate the idea, and if we don't allow for creativity. So jazz, this bandstand is absolutely amazing. It's a very purifying experience. And I know I speak for all of us when I tell you that we don't take it for granted. We know to be able to come on the bandstand and play music is a blessing. And the other dynamic of it is that we don't micromanage in jazz. What that does is it actually limits the artistic possibilities, right? If I come up and I dictate to the band that I want to play like this, and I want the music to go this way, and I just jump right in. Ready? Just play some time. One, two, a one, two, three, four. Ah! Right? It's kind of chaotic because I'm bullying my ideas. I'm telling you, come with me over this way. If I really want the music to go there, the best way for me to do it is to listen. This is a science of listening. It has far more to do with what I can perceive than what it is that I can do. So if I want the music to get to a certain level of intensity, the first step for me is to be patient, to listen to what's going on, and pull from something that's going on around me. When you do that, you engage and inspire the other musicians, and they give you more, and gradually it builds. Watch. One, two, one, two, three, four. Thank you. totally different experience when I'm pulling ideas. It's much more organic, much more nuanced. It's not about bullying my vision or anything like that. It's about being here in the moment, accepting one another, and allowing creativity to flow. Thank you.
Jazz musician Stefan Harris from his TED Talk. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Today we're talking about mistakes. I'm Guy Raz. Stay with us. Back in a moment. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And today on the show, we're talking about being wrong, making mistakes.
Oh, what a fabulous subject.
And this next story comes from Margaret Heffernan.
I could talk about mistakes forever.
Well, we're going to, which is great. Margaret's an entrepreneur, guru, business type person.
And I spent 10 years in Boston running software companies.
What do you do now?
Now I write full-time and I mentor chief executives.
I thought you were going to say I mentor inner-city children, but you said I mentor chief executives.
Well, everybody needs help. You
know? So anyway, Margaret's story is about a woman, a doctor, actually.
Yes.
Named Alice Stewart.
Well, Alice Stewart was a physician in England pretty much at the time of the Second World War. She is very unusual.
Partly because, of course, she was a woman, which was pretty rare in the 1950s.
Well, this is Margaret's TED Talk.
And she was brilliant. She was one of the, at the time, the youngest fellow to be elected to the Royal College of Physicians. She was unusual, too, because she continued to work after she got married, after she had kids, and even after she got divorced and was a single parent, she continued her medical work. And she was unusual because she was really interested in a new science, the emerging field of epidemiology, the study of patterns in disease. But like every scientist, she appreciated that to make her mark, what she needed to do was find a hard problem and solve it. The hard problem that Alice chose was the rising incidence of childhood cancers. Most disease is correlated with poverty, but in the case of childhood cancers, the children who were dying seemed mostly to come from affluent families. So what, she wanted to know, could explain this anomaly? Now, Alice had trouble getting funding for her research. In the end, she got just £1,000 from the Lady Tata Memorial Prize, and that meant she knew she only had one shot at collecting her data.
So she wrote up a single questionnaire for the parents of the victims, but she didn't really know what to look for.
This really was a needle in a haystack sort of search, so she asked everything she could think of.
You know, did you eat tinned sweets? Had you been exposed to automobile exhaust? What were your parents' occupation? How old were your parents when you were conceived? Were you raised with livestock? You know, a very inclusive questionnaire.
That's Gail Green.
I teach at Scripps College. Anything else?
She also wrote a biography about Alice Stewart.
Yeah, my book is The Woman Who Knew Too Much.
And Gail spent a lot of time with Alice.
Yeah, she was so much fun to be with. She would set people at ease.
Say again what that unpublished or sort of unpublished Japanese study did.
There's in the accumulated reference list for the year.
This is audio of Gail hanging out with Alice in her cottage near Oxford in 1996.
Another coffee break.
Oh, then have another coffee break.
Alice died 8 years after this recording, but over the course of several months, she told Gail that back in the 1950s, when so many children were dying of cancer, but no one could figure out why.
She had the revolutionary idea to ask the moms. Ask the moms, she said. Ask the moms.
Because most researchers at the time would have just been like, well, what do the mothers know?
You know, what are they going to tell us? But she had a feeling that the mothers might remember something that, you know, the doctors didn't know about.
And as the forms started to come back, one thing jumped out with just fantastic statistical clarity of a kind that, you know, really most scientists only dream of. And that was that by a difference of really 3-1, the kids who had died of cancer had had mothers who had been x-rayed when they were pregnant.
That was one of Alice's questions to those moms.
had you had an obstetric x-ray while pregnant?
And nobody had ever asked that question.
No. It's like this answer, this result just cracked open an entire edifice of claims that were made about radiation.
Remember, this was the 1950s. People were getting x-rays in shoe stores. And to say this amazing new technology was dangerous at any level?
That finding flew in the face of conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom held that everything was safe up to a point, a threshold. It flew in the face of conventional wisdom, which was huge enthusiasm for the cool new technology of that age, which was the x-ray machine. And it flew in the face of doctors' idea of themselves, which was as people who helped patients, they didn't harm them. Nevertheless, Alice Stewart rushed to publish her preliminary findings in The Lancet in 1956. People got very excited. There was talk of the Nobel Prize. And Alice really was in a big hurry to try to study all the cases of childhood cancer she could find before they disappeared. In fact, she need not have hurried. It was fully 25 years before the British and American medical establishments abandoned the practice of x-raying pregnant women. The data was out there, it was open, it was freely available, but nobody wanted to know. A child a week was dying, but nothing changed. Openness alone can't drive change. So for 25 years, Alice Stewart had a very big fight on her hands. So how did she know that she was right? Well, she had a fantastic model for thinking.
Not just a model, a partner, a statistician named George Neal.
And George was pretty much everything that Alice wasn't. So Alice was very outgoing and sociable.
But George?
He was...
And George was a recluse.
A numbers person.
Alice was very warm, very empathetic with her patients.
She had a marvelous hands-on medical experience.
George frankly preferred numbers to people.
And he, you know, he said at one point...
This fantastic thing about their working relationship. He said, my job is to prove Dr. Stewart...
To try to prove Dr. Stewart wrong.
He actively sought disconfirmation, different ways of looking at her models, at her statistics, different ways of crunching the data in order to disprove her.
She was prepared not to always be right.
Yeah, and she said, I actually think that a researcher, it's the best thing that can happen to any researcher, is to have opposition.
Because it was only by not being able to prove that she was wrong that George could give Alice the confidence she needed to know that she was right.
She said it was like playing with a better tennis partner. You should always try to find a better tennis partner.
Thinking partners who aren't echo chambers. It's a fantastic model of collaboration. I wonder how many of us have or dare to have such collaborators.
I mean, you even say in your talk that we're kind of like neurobiologically driven to seek out people who are like us, not unlike us.
That's right. Well, I think this is really interesting. So what we know is that the brain is quite lazy in a way, or you could call it efficient, depending on your point of view. And so we take lots of shortcuts. And the way that our brain takes shortcuts is to look at something and think, is this like something else I know? So we're going through life looking for matches. Now, the problem with that is that what's most familiar to us is us. So anything that agrees with us, we tend to trust. We know that we're drawn to people who are physically very similar to ourselves, to think that people are terribly smart if their thinking is like ours, if they look like us, talk like us. We tend to read newspapers that hold the same political opinion or bias that we do. So We organize a huge amount of our life and our learning to surround ourselves with people and information that reinforce our opinions and don't challenge them. But I think what I found so inspiring about looking at the relationship between Alice Stewart and George Neal was that they were prepared to invest time and energy in the relationship, which allowed them to challenge each other.
Alice and George were very good at conflict. They saw it as thinking. So what does that kind of constructive conflict require? Well, first of all, it requires that we find people who are very different from ourselves. People with different backgrounds, different disciplines, different ways of thinking, and different experience, and find ways to engage with them. That requires a lot of patience and a lot of energy. And it also means that we have to be prepared to change our minds. Alice's daughter told me that every time Alice went head-to-head with a fellow scientist, they made her think and think and think again. My mother, she said, my mother didn't enjoy a fight, but she was really good at them. So it's one thing to do that in a one-to-one relationship, but it strikes me that the biggest problems we face, many of the biggest disasters that we've experienced, mostly haven't come from individuals, they've come from organizations, some of them bigger than countries, many of them capable of affecting hundreds, thousands, even millions of lives. So how do organizations think? Well, for the most part, they don't. And that isn't because they don't want to. It's really because they can't. And they can't because the people inside of them are too afraid of conflict.
How do you sort of reward people who do that, who acknowledge mistakes? I mean, you know, we don't have that kind of system right now.
Yeah.
I mean, you're...
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I've sometimes worked with companies and suggested, you know, they have an award for the best mistake, you know, which is essentially the, you know, not this stupid mistake, and obviously not the mistake that you make twice, because that shows you're not learning. But, you know, the mistake that offers the greatest amount of insight and that therefore allows for the largest amount of improvement. And if you can see top people acknowledging mistakes, it makes it much easier for everybody else to acknowledge mistakes. But one of the things I certainly learned in the course of my research was that some of the worst institutional or organizational disasters and sometimes even crimes come about because mistakes are made and buried. And I really passionately believe that mistakes are a fantastic opportunity to learn. And however terrible they are, and some are terrible, nothing makes it worse except covering it up.
See, it makes complete sense, right? You would make a mistake and you would learn from that, and then you would be a better person or you would do your job better.
Yeah,
or whatever. But our whole lives are set up inside a reward system that's designed to encourage you not to make mistakes, right? I mean, we get graded in school for coloring in the lines or for our penmanship, and then we're penalized when we do make mistakes.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point. And in fact, we do bring children up to imagine that there is a right answer and that intelligence is about knowing that right answer. And therefore, if you get a wrong answer, you're stupid. So what we do is we teach people not even so much to have a passion for the right answer, but have great talent for second guessing what everybody wants the answer to be. So you see this in the workplace a lot, which is if I ask a question of a team of people, a very large proportion of them, instead of really thinking about the problem, will think, what does the boss want the answer to be? Well, that's incredibly uncreative, and it shuts down the possibility for superior answers. So I think, you know, I think our fear of mistakes hugely impedes our creativity.
I think we need to be teaching these skills to kids and adults at every stage of their development if we want to have thinking organizations and a thinking society. The fact is that most of the biggest catastrophes that we've witnessed rarely come from information that is secret or hidden. It comes from information that is freely available and out there, but that we are willfully blind to because we can't handle, don't want to handle, the conflict that it provokes. But when we dare to break that silence, or when we dare to see, and we create conflict, we enable ourselves and the people around us to do our very best thinking. Open information is fantastic. Open networks are essential. But the truth won't set us free until we develop the skills and the habit and the talent and the moral courage to use it. Openness isn't the end. It's the beginning.
So Alice Stewart is this example, right? She's this person that we hear about and in some ways we should almost try to be. But I wonder if it took a certain level of confidence that most of us just don't have.
Well, I don't think it was that Alice had confidence in herself. I think she had confidence in the method, that if there were something wrong with her science, that the data would prove it. I mean, although clearly she was very angry with the medical establishment that wouldn't pay any attention, she seems somehow to have been very gifted at not taking it too personally. She really understood it was a fight. She had to have the fight. But she didn't think when people attacked the science that they were attacking her. And I think it's quite hard for us often to step back and think, actually, let's just argue about the issues. And also, let's accept that if, when we have this conflict, it turns out I'm wrong, I've learned something. I want to know if I'm wrong, because I'd rather be right. So if I'm wrong, let's find out.
Oops, my heart went oops the moment that we met. My heart went oops, I never will forget. My heart turned hoops the moment that I met you.
Margaret Heffernan's full talk can be found at ted.npr.org. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download the show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And oops, a heart went oops.
Sitting on the scoops, the local droops.
They nearly flipped their tubes, I mean in groups.
The silly way we acted.
Of course they couldn't know that you were so aglow.
And I was so attracted.
Yes, baby, take a bow. My heart is going oops, oops,
oops,
oops,
oops,
right now.
Oops. Oops, dear.